kitchen is a magical place where everything happens. The alchemy of food and the human interaction. It is the most visited place in every household. Every single conversation of love, of life, of family revolves pretty much around the kitchen counter at dinner table. Trans POV Kitchen is a substream of the popular transgender point of view on Joy 94.9. Hosted by Anastasia Lee, a passionate cook and a food scientist, please pop into our kitchen to listen to some humor, swapping for a few recipe ideas, some tips and tricks, or just simply having a company when you cook in solidarity. Welcome back to another episode on Trans POV Kitchen, and this is Anastasia. So in the room today, I have Thomas Morgan, who has been on the show earlier.
Yes, I had one little debut with Trans POV Kitchen, and I'm back again.
Yeah. So recently, we had this amazing dynamic conversation around roast pork.
We did. Well, of course, it started out because you were teasing some of us online with your amazing roast pork that you just produced, you know, just because you wanted a light snack, which I love that.
Yeah.
And so I wanted to hear all of your secrets because it looked amazing.
So how are we going to do it? Am I going to share with you first and you're going to exchange some
wisdom? I mean, I want to hear all those details. I want to know exactly you, the master chef that you are.
I don't think I am a master chef, but I do what I've been told, and of course, I do apply a bit of my knowledge when it comes to cooking from university, because I did food science and nutrition, and we were sort of informed and educated on all of these reactions happen in cooking. So I guess for the crackling, that's actually what most people would be curious about.
Yes, well, that is the glorious point. And crackling that doesn't ruin the rest of the pork as a result. Some people are so focused on that that you end up with sort of dry pork and things, because they just want that picturesque crackling.
For me personally, I make sure I stab the piece of pork belly with a sharp knife on the skin. So you prick the skin, but then make sure you don't really puncture down to the meat layer, just the skin only. And then lots of salt on top. So the salt is going to draw out the moisture from the skin. And then you apply paper towel, so it's going to absorb all this excess water out of the skin. And if you have time, I would prefer to have this be done the night before, so it has time to rest in the fridge, because the dry air in the fridge helps really dry up the skin.
And I think that's probably one of the tips that I really took on board, and probably one that some people are a little bit cagey about doing. You know, this idea that food always needs to be covered, it always needs to be, you know, cling wrapped or...
Well, but then if you think about it, like, we do age meat, like, you know, like with beef, we age them in like a dry fridge. And why can't we do it in our fridge? You know, as long as you have them in like a proper container that doesn't drip to the lower compartment, I think it's fine.
Yes, no, absolutely. Yeah. And cleanliness is important.
And then so for me, roast pork, the biggest enemy would be moisture and water. So that's why when I marinate my pork belly, I actually use all powder form. So garlic powder.
Oh, so you
powder,
do like a dry rub?
Yeah, like so a dry rub is in dry form rather than, you know, their fresh form.
Fair.
Just to avoid that. And then for colouring, you can actually use red wine vinegar. So when you take the piece of pork belly out of the fridge, about 10 minutes, you know, before you chuck it into the oven, you rub a bit of red wine vinegar to give a bit of colour, and, you know, and a bit of oil on top, and you just massage it into the skin.
That is cute. And also, I suppose the vinegar helps with drying it out as well because of the... Yeah. Dry. But I was interested because you do refer to specifically using pork belly. Yeah. Is that the only cut that you tend to work with?
I guess you can use pork loin or pork hock, you know, like the leg.
Which does have amazing flavour.
I love that cut the most, actually. Especially when I have time. Actually, when I'm more like lazy and I don't want to think of, you know, anything to go with it, I would have the pork hock, the pork legs, on top of a bed of fennel and apple, like chopped, and onions, and a bit of stout underneath. And so you roast it, and I do the same thing with the skin outside. So yeah,
I love that you think that is lazy cooking. That sounds fabulous.
I mean, like for me, it's just like, you know, okay, everything goes into the pan, and done, you know, and you forget about it for like an hour and a half. And
which is
it.
The brilliant thing about doing a roast is that yeah. as long as you do all your prep work and things, you can then attend to other things. Maybe exactly. have a gentleman or and lady caller come past. Maybe you just need to beautify yourself yeah. or go back
and,
your own regime.
And I think another crucial thing when it comes to making pork crackling or roast pork, either matter, is that your oven needs to be hot and make sure it's on fair and force.
Fair. And so now most people, I guess, would be worried about having it up that high that things are just going to burn. They're either going to forget about it or, yeah, exactly. You know, it's you sort of hear like 180, maybe 200 degrees Celsius yep. is about the maximum that anyone really uses yep. it. But from what you're mentioning off air, you go a lot hotter than that.
Yeah, so I always preheat my oven to the highest. And while waiting for the oven to be warmed up, I would rub that red wine vinegar and oil onto the skin and leave them out in the fridge for a bit. And then as soon as the pork belly or the piece of pork goes into the oven, I turn it down to 200. So, you know, that initial high heat sort of, you know, give the meat a bit of a head start. Like it
sort of
like,
sears it in.
Yeah, sort of. Yeah, just like that.
And so do you raise the temperature again at the end?
Yes, I do. So, to say for 1 kilo of pork with that bone, you know, so 200 degrees Celsius for about 45 minutes to okay. 50 minutes. And then I crank the heat up to 220 to 225 for another 15 minutes or until it's all like, you know, it has this layer of bubbles on top, you know, of the skin.
Well, yeah, and you do get that picturesque crackling. I have to admit, it's one area that I have never had a lot of success with. Mm. And I mean, I suppose it's a little bit old school. I always tend to score the pork skin rather than yeah. do the pinprick method.
Oh, well, I guess because I was so angry. I mean, for me, it's therapeutic, you know?
Fair.
Stabbing
and,
something.
You know, and I know that you are someone who puts a lot of love into your cooking. And so exactly. what is love without a little bit of hate as well?
I know. I mean, there's always a fine line. There's always a fine line between love and hate, isn't it?
You know? As long as there's passion, I suppose that's yeah. the important thing.
And I guess, you know, because normally I tend to carry out my frustration during the day onto that. And, you know, it was, you know, it's always therapeutic to let your anger out somewhere.
See, it's a whole different kind of food therapy. For me, it's just eating terrible food as a way of, if you know, eating my feelings. But clearly I need to be a bit more physical with
yeah,
it.
Yeah, or, you know, imagine, like, you know, so say when you make your own breadcrumbs, instead of using a food processor, just chuck them into the sandwich bag and bash them with your rolling pin. And that's how you release your stresses.
So how much damage have you done to your counters in the meantime?
Not so much. Not so much.
So it is with some carefulness. It is with some yeah. limitation. Now, the other thing I wanted to run by with you is the topic that is very near and dear to me, mm-hmm. which is the topic of fat.
Yes.
Now, we all talk about, you know, obviously healthy eating and we shouldn't have too much fat in our diets and things. Mm. But with roasting, you do need a fairly reasonable amount of fat to work with
yep.
in order to keep that succulence.
Yeah, well, yeah, this is another thing. Pork belly, especially the battery-raised pigs, they contain a lot of fat already.
So should we be trimming some of that away when we're preparing our pork belly? Or?
Well, I tend to keep the fat.
Me too.
Because it actually helps to keep the meat moist during the cooking process. And it's a layer. It's like a protective layer between the crackling and the meat.
And so what about basting? You don't do any basting or anything?
No, like I just leave it in there and just get on with my life for like an hour and a half. And
so just like a good exercise regime, you just let it drip away.
Exactly. Exactly.
Well, yes, because one of my preferred pork roasting dishes, particularly when I'm feeling that little bit extra, want to do something a bit special, yeah. Is a dish that's known as porchetta. And now, and that does exactly go to that theory, because technically porchetta refers to roasting or preparing a whole young pig.
Wow.
As opposed to, no, apparently it's different to a suckling pig, which is a whole different thing, but the official Italian term is preparing a whole pig. In the more common, like modern, I guess, recipes for it. Mm-hmm. When it refers to porchetta, it's more of a, I suppose, it's referring to preparing it like you're preparing a whole pig. So you're obviously not actually doing the whole thing because, you know, you need, it takes a village to really do that properly. But what you do is you use a nice lean loin of pork.
Yep.
But because there isn't much fat there or anything, you use pork belly as a second layer to provide both the skin for the crackling and the fat. Mm. And so You take your loin, make sure it's trimmed up nice and neat. You then do a rub of herbs. So it's usually rosemary should always be in there, black pepper and garlic. Some people like to add orange, either just the zest or a bit more, and some fennel. I personally, I'm not big on orange, and I find fennel can be a bit strong.
Yeah, well,
I enjoy the taste.
Orange and pork, I've never had that before.
Oh yeah, no, orange and pork is a very, I guess it's more of a like a British or European thing.
You reckon?
Yeah.
Okay, because I mean, like fennel is quite star anise and licorice kind of tasting. It does go well with like meat, especially like pork and beef.
Fair,
but
and it also balances orange. Nicely with citrus.
But I guess yeah, orange like the. The sourness sort of cuts through the richness of
exactly.
the meat.
Yeah.
Okay, interesting.
And so I'm not so big on the fennel and citrus, but it is an option.
Yep.
You then, so if it's fennel seeds, you roast them along with maybe some chili peppers or, you know, whatever sort of dry spices you want to prepare. Yep. Rub that down in between the layer of the loin and then putting the pork belly over the top. Trim it around and you obviously tie it off and make sure it's all secure.
Yeah.
And then you go about the same way of preparing. So either scoring or pinpricking the skin, making sure it is dried out, which I am going to take your tip about leaving it in the fridge to dry out after you've prepared it. Yeah.
So no cling wrap, nothing. Just leave it, just make sure that you have like a blade.
Absolutely. Because the last thing you want is it dripping on anything else and contaminating.
Yeah. And just make sure that it's exposed to as many dry air in the fridge as possible.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and so, and because I tend to do more of the scoring across the skin, what I'll sometimes do is, particularly if I'm preparing it a little bit more quickly, is pinprick the underside of the pork belly to help get that flavor from all those herbs and the spices soaking into that meat and the fat layer. And then, so as it roasts down and all sort of melds together, you get this almost roulant type effect. It's obviously not a full, it's not wrapped right around, but you get that mixture of herbs and freshness amongst the meat and fat. And it's a really lovely, festive dish. So it's particularly good if you're doing a big family roast or maybe for Christmas or something, which is often when I produce it.
I'd make that for myself.
I mean, you can attempt to have a dinner party, and then if you just happen to cancel on everyone, you have this lovely pork roast that you prepared earlier.
Well, remember that piece of pork belly I had? Like, literally, I finished the whole thing, which was about like a kilo, almost a kilo and a half of meat by myself in one night.
Atta girl. Like, I like a person.
I was so sick, though. I was so sick. And it was like,
you need the protein. You need those nutrients.
Oh, my God. Like, it was like the first kind of solid food I had in like 4 or 5 days. Because it was bedbound and I was like consuming like fluid mostly. So, yeah.
Fair. Well, clearly, and it's done a body good.
It
like,
helped.
It's serving you just fine. And I will never judge a person who eats. In fact, you can give them my number.
Okay. So, when you pinprick the meat, do you just like use like the tip of the knife?
Yeah, just really short. Because you just want it in a little bit just to help get it soaking in. Obviously, you don't want to end up with, a bit of pork belly that's basically falling apart because it's been, you know, that's how you get pulled pork more than anything else if you go too nuts with it.
Yeah.
So just down to maybe the first fat layer, because you know how with pork belly, it tends to have a sort of a multi-layer approach. So just that little bit just to help get it soaking in there a bit more.
Mm. And then for me, another thing, I'm very cautious with roasting pork to provide like the best of cracklings would be making sure when the piece of pork goes into the oven, everything is on the same level. Like the skin is like flat.
Fair.
So you get even amount of heat and exposure to hot air on the surface.
Well, because the more sort of classic, I suppose, European, like a leg of pork or something like that does tend to be in the round. And when you go to the supermarket, for example, a lot of the roasts do tend to be pre-tied and things into a round. So you'd actually recommend flattening that back out and having it as a flat
with,
bed.
With pork hock, I actually asked my butcher to get rid of the bones.
Oh, okay. So it's been pre-butterflied.
Yeah, pre-butterflied. And then, I just wrap it. I do it the same way you do with your pork loin.
Right.
I make a dry wrap and then wrap inside like the meat interior and roll it and make it like nice and tight. And I roast it.
But obviously, but making sure it's not too inconsistent in terms of its role, I think it seems to be what you're saying.
Yeah, but then, it's just like, try your best to get as many even surface area as possible. as you can.
Yeah, duly noted. Yeah. Definitely keep on that
and then,
one.
And then, however, if you... I mean, I do enjoy having the bone intact sometimes, though, because it makes actually, like, once you trim everything off the bones, you use that bone to make stock, and it's just amazing.
That's true.
I don't waste anything, so...
And particularly when you don't have to be... You're not being particularly fancy, or it doesn't have to look particularly glam in serving, because carving around a bone can be a little bit tricky.
Yeah, it can be.
But you're right. You know, it's important not to, to waste things. And so if you have the opportunity to be able to do that, you can then make a lovely soup stock.
And I've noticed that, you know, whenever I make that German-inspired pork hock, like roast pork hock, whenever I have the bone intact, like the gravy underneath with the apple and the stout and the onions and the fennel, it tastes richer. And I like it. And I assume that it's from the marrow, it's from the...
Absolutely.
The bones that come down. And it's just, it's more flavorsome.
Well, see, and I do enjoy, you know, eating meat off the bone. I was raised with the adage, the closer the bone, the sweeter the meat.
Yeah.
Which I do take with that what you will. But, yeah, I mean, I think that's a great tip. There was one thing I was going to ask you, though. When you're doing a roast and you're turning the temperature back up toward the end of it, do you... deglaze the pan before you raise the temperature again? Do you take those drippings off to do your gravy or anything first?
Well, depends. Depends on what I'm going to have the roast pork with, actually. Because in Vietnam, like when we roast a piece of pork, we tend to have it in like a vermicelli salad.
Okay, yep.
Whatever left in the pan is not really necessary. Like we don't really keep it.
Okay.
But then since I came here and I've been westernized with my taste and my cooking, sometimes I do keep that juice and make a gravy with it.
Or just as long as it doesn't get too acrid. Because if you start getting those burnt corners and things, that can really affect the flavor of whatever
your drippings are. So that's why if I'm having like a more Caucasian kind of meal with a roast pork, again, I would have like a bed of apple and onions and a fennel underneath. And then so they will be slowly based and cooked in that juice as well.
Yeah, no, I'm definitely going to give... I need to be less lazy with doing those sorts of...
And I guess halfway during the cooking process, you can always pour in a bit of a cider.
Okay.
You know, it's just to deglaze a pan and keep things from being burnt.
And so that evaporating off while it's cooking, that won't affect the crackling?
Well, make sure that when you pour the cider in, it doesn't reach to the skin.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. But even just it evaporating off, you know, it's steaming away, that's not going to...
It won't.
Brilliant.
It's just alcohol, so it won't. And then because you're using fan force.
Ah, fair. So ventilation counts.
Yeah, the ventilation really helps to withdraw, like drawing out all of the moisture from the oven too.
And so if you do have an oven that maybe isn't quite so fancy and powerful and doesn't have a fan force... in it, would you recommend when doing that just leaving the door open a little bit so it can ventilate a bit?
Yes, with a non-fan oven, I would suggest you to reduce the heat down to 180 instead.
Okay, fair.
Because 200 degrees Celsius can be quite vicious.
Absolutely. I mean, we are talking about, 100 degrees is burning temperature and it's twice that.
And then also, I'm using an oven, like a gas oven from the 1980s, and I would count it as like an old-fashioned one, but it works perfectly.
Oh, true. And in fairness, gas ovens, I think, are where it's at. I know a lot of people have moved back to using electric because they say it's more consistent and things, but I always find gas works much better.
Exactly. Even like my best cakes are always made from that oven compared to the ones I made from at my friend's place.
Right.
In an electrical one. So, yeah. I don't know why people get so funny about gas oven.
Yeah. No, I think it's because there was a notion that it was inconsistent. But, of course, if you're unsure about that, and particularly if it is an older oven, you can always get one of those meat thermometers or oven thermometers.
Yeah.
And just move that around in the oven just when you've used it a couple of different times. Yeah. Put it in a different spot and just monitor how consistent the temperature is.
Yeah, and then I suppose, you know your oven better than anybody else.
Theory.
My oven, like closer to the door, the heat is more vicious to the back. So what I do, and especially on the right-hand side, it's always stronger, the heat. So what I do is like I actually put the meat tray slightly diagonal.
Okay, so offset.
Yeah,
right.
Just to offset everything. Yeah, at the end of the day, you know the space you cook in and you understand it better than anybody else. So yeah, just do your best.
That's brilliant.
And also, speaking of which, now we can actually move on to other meat we've talked about. So just then, we were talking about trans men in gay spaces.
Yes.
So, and I know that, you've been around for quite a while in the gay community.
Hey, I'm not that old.
I mean, you've been out and proud for quite a while.
Yes, I've been around for a minute.
Compared to me. I guess you have more experience and you have more time.
Well, and I do like to, I guess, people watch a bit, you know, whenever I'm in various spaces and things. I'm not always the most with it and popular kid. I'm not always, you know, hitting it up on the dance floor. Sometimes I do like to have a nice glass of wine or something, you know, and just stand off to the side and watch people and how they interact and, yeah, and how the spaces are.
So, of course, you do go out. And about trans people.
Yes.
What are your take on, like, have you seen any progression in our community?
Absolutely. And I think there has been a little bit more visibility, whether it's in terms of media or I suppose with various elements within our communities with trans women. Yeah. But what I've been noticing now is more visibility for trans men, which I think is brilliant because I think they have been a slightly invisible group within our community at times. And, you know, to some, and both visibility in terms of the sort of outward identity and acknowledgement of being trans men, but also just the indifference of it. And I don't mean that in a negative way. I just mean in not separating them from the other male community, that they're just one of the people. So I've been to events that were some of the men only events, and that it can be a very controversial topic that within our communities.
Yes, I actually got caught up within that sort of time, you know, when one of the most popular club actually asked me to stand on the other line and waiting for hours in the cold.
And then,
you know, and I'm like, okay, interesting. And then whereas my cisgender straight friend, he was just a guy and he was allowed to stand in the other line and he got and go the privilege straight in. To go straight in. And I'm like, he's not even gay. He's straight.
Yeah.
And then, you know, and then I was like, well, you know what? Because like he wanted to stay with me. And I said, well, this is your first time here. You may as well just go in and enjoy now. I mean, I've been here for like all the time. So, you know, every weekend. So.
But I mean, isn't there a touch of irony in that?
It's just so funny.
You are a member of our community
and he was more
of an ally. And yet he was the one getting preferential treatment.
And this is the thing. Like, I felt like I used to be ashamed admitting that I'm a trans person, I'm a trans woman.
Well, because it's having to make a bold statement. I mean, it's really sort of separating yourself out there.
And then, you know, imagine like, you know, and all these spaces sort of when you grew up in, you know, except for me because I came from overseas and, you know, like those spaces were the only space I could enter feeling safe. And then out of nowhere, just because I've decided to live authentically.
Right.
I got excluded.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm like, this is very interesting.
And so there was, I mean, with me, there was one of the events that was men only that I go to. It was a one where people tend to wear slightly less clothing.
I know. I've been there.
It wasn't full nudist or anything like that. I don't want to, you know, paint too many images, but there are some of these events out there.
Yeah.
It was an underwear party. These are a thing. And so one of the guys who was a friend of a friend, we'd, you know, been along to a few of these events before, and it came up randomly in conversation that he was a trans man. And I honestly hadn't even thought about it. It you know, hadn't come up for me. It didn't, you know, click at all. And I was just like, oh, okay, awesome. Yeah. But then I thought it was interesting that even probably a few years ago, that would have gotten a reaction. That would have been like, oh, is this space for them? You know, are they a part of this, et cetera, et cetera. But I thought, yeah, no, awesome. He's part of the group. He's having a good time. We're all good. There's no expectation that anyone has to provide anything specific there. And he just was. And then probably a few months later, at the same venue, they mentioned that they'd gotten a message or a letter from a trans man who had come along to, again, one of these men-only events and was saying how welcome he felt and how, you know, wonderful it was. And he was surprised and because he didn't think he was welcome. He didn't think he was allowed to go there.
Yeah.
And my reaction was like, yeah, of course he is. Of course.
It's very interesting.
You're allowed to be there. And there's a number of people who I just wouldn't even presume to ask, you know, whether they're cis or transgender. I wouldn't presume to define what they can and can't do, as long as you identify as male in that space. And that's just one specific space that happened to be male only. I think there should be more female only venues, or at least female focused venues.
Yeah.
And it's a shame that we've lost so many of them in Melbourne. And of course, inclusive spaces where everyone can get together. I think it's important for everyone to have their safe spaces and their, you know, their one-offs, as well as inclusion and engagement.
Well, this happened to me. I think I know that the venue you were talking about. And 2 or 3 years ago, when I was still sort of juggling with my identity, I was invited to a friend's party that happened to be there. And of course, it's a male-only venue, and I was representing myself more female or like more feminine. I was wearing heels and of course like bra, even with, you know, but then with a male body.
Right.
And I was refused entry.
Right.
And what really stuck in my mind still is that the bouncer or the manager there or whoever worked there back then, well, told me to, well, if you take off your bra and your heels, then you can come in.
So it was more about how presenting or identifying.
Yeah.
And I was like, a thing of.
Okay, this is very interesting. And then I've never felt so belittled. I've never felt so hated. And I guess, you know, since then, I've grown to love women more, you know.
Right.
Because I understand the things they have to go through, you know. It's just so, it was quite an experience for me. And then I do believe that with trans men, they do get away with things because men bodies are not as policed as women's bodies.
Yes. I think that is certainly a factor there. That, because I admit, I hadn't really thought about twice with, you know, some of these trans guys, some who I knew were trans guys, others who I just didn't even think or realize, or it just never came up.
Yeah.
That I guess, you know, I wasn't inspecting them. I wasn't, you know.
But then as soon as a woman who is at the, like, just say, like, even for myself, I am slightly taller than the average woman. And then, so, of course, there would be scrutiny around me as well. Whereas, like, with a guy, I know, like, height is an issue with a guy. But it's not, like, a big of a conversation where people actually scrutinize him for how short he is.
Yes, you know? No, I think it tends to be something, if anything, that's more internalized. Yeah. I've heard from men, both, again, cis and trans men, who are shorter in stature, who they're concerned about it. But I've never actually heard anyone else be like, oh, that guy's too short. This isn't enough. Exactly. You need to be X or Y to be...
But then,
you know,
for a woman, like, it's just... It's
a perfect height. Not too tall, not too short. You have to be this,
so
you have
hard.
To be that.
Yeah, and then I realize how, as a community together, we should really help women of all kinds to be more liberated from all these constraints and suppression.
Yes, yeah. No, I think that's absolutely a pathway that we're still working on. And I suppose, you know, in some degrees, it sometimes doesn't help that with fashion and beauty and things, there's all these heightened standards that we then try to impose on everyone.
Yeah.
But the way I always look at it is that, particularly high-end fashion, that is an art form. That is something that is separated from reality.
Yeah.
It's nice. It can be pretty and things, but that shouldn't be then used as a blueprint that then all other women, particularly because they are the ones who the fashion industry have focused on extremely heavily over the years, you know, should then be held to that standard.
Yeah.
Fashion and art is one thing, and that's lovely, but that has no bearing on 51% of our population.
On the reality, yes. I guess it's just that, you know, our education system somehow plays a part in this too, that we constantly strive for fantasy.
Yes.
Rather than reality. And that's what I've learned from conversation with kids. You know, like kids these days, they look on Instagram and Snapchat and they're like, oh, she has these earrings and this, we have it. Or like that guy, he has that, you know, wallet or that brand. And, you know, they rush into it and they want to live that fantasy.
But they also don't necessarily, and it is a fantasy because they don't necessarily know what is going on with the rest of their lives.
Yeah.
They don't know if these people are, you know, maybe they're shopping at Target or Kmart or, you know, one of the other sort of more generic brands for, you know, 5-6 days out of the week.
Yeah.
And they're wearing, you know, very basic clothing. They might be, you know, not eating properly in terms of being able to afford proper food and things. They might be, you know, and I'm saying this in terms of them skimping on other areas just so they can afford that one outfit that is perfect fashion and stylish and what's in, or those right accessories. And so when people see an Instagram feed full of people with the right accessories, the right brands, the right places, the right this, the right that, it can feel like that's the entire world, that's this entire existence, that people are just living that lifestyle and it's all perfect and they have all the best things. But when really it's just one photo from this person, one photo from that person, one photo that was from 2 months ago.
It's 2D surface. It's all like two-dimensional.
Yeah. And it doesn't give the breadth of what the actual lived experience is for just individual people. You just see this collective. It's just this sort of, I think it's too overpowering for a lot of people to process.
Yeah. I do agree with that. And, you know, I'm so glad that we see more trans male being more open and being proud, like just like with that fashion week in New York.
Yes.
Where Marco, you know, like the designer and the wear brand, he featured like an all transgender cast.
Yeah, and it looked like it was a fabulous show, yeah.
And then, you know, like some of the guys, they just proudly walk bare-chested.
Right.
With the scars on. Yep. And I'm like, and it really moved me, you know, and all these girls, like gorgeous, and they own their body, you know. They own their thighs and they own their hips and they own all these features that they have. And it's amazing. And I think we are heading, America at least, or like the scene in America, is heading to the right direction, and I hope Australia can sort of follow.
And that it stays there consistently, because sometimes we do see there can be these campaigns and it can sort of be getting in the right direction, and then something new comes up and it sort of pulls things back to a different ideal or a different expectation.
Yeah.
So hopefully this will be a continuation of this, because people's lived experiences and the reality of who they are should be acknowledged and celebrated, not just as a campaign or a particular one day a year. Going throughout.
Okay, one last question before we conclude this amazing episode. Do you think Australia is still behind on a lot of things?
Yes. I mean, I think in short, I think we've being on the other side of the world, we tend to have a history of being disengaged, whether it was technology, politics, fashion. You know, when our autumn is their spring, so when spring collections come out, usually by the time we get it, it's 6 months after when, you know, everything's moving on. And I think also in terms of some of the politics and some of the identity campaigning, we can be a bit behind as well. Mm. I think there is a historical notion of egalitarianism in Australia, and that idea of being a bit plain and straightforward.
Yeah.
I sometimes wonder if that's still the case. I think there was a notion of that that was perhaps still a bit exclusive, you know.
Mm.
You were okay and accepted within certain fields, like in terms of being working class versus middle class, or, you know, being more country or regional versus, you know, urban centres.
Mm.
But that doesn't necessarily mean we're all that inclusive to other ethnic minorities, to other gender and, like, our communities, you know, minorities. I think we are coming a long way fairly quickly.
Yeah.
I think there is a reaction from, I guess, the older generations, or those who are used to the status quo, where it seems like there is a lot of change coming on very quickly. And you know what, that's true, but it might be because we've got more catching up to do. So I think we're getting there, being a smaller population, being a bit disconnected from the, particularly I think the rest of the Western world. I think we are engaging more of the East now, and that's great, but there's other than cultural factors to play in. I think it's a very different mix. I think people like to equate Australian identity and culture to American identity and culture. And there's certainly some of that, and there's a lot of idealizing of the...
Especially with our new PM, you know, we soon will be America.
Yes. it's been an interesting pathway with politics. Yes. One day we will have a leader that's actually around for longer terms to be able to actually instill a consistency. Just
and
once...
who's not a religious fanatic, you know?
Well, that would be nice too. I admit I've kind of disengaged from some of the politics these days. I'm hoping that it's by the time the next election comes around, we can sort of figure out where it all stands. Exactly. It's not too long now. Time disappears off. Mm. Let's see where it all heads.
Well, hopefully it's going to go for the better for us and for everybody.
Yeah, so it's certainly just not any more steps backwards.
Because for me, for politicians, all they care is the seats in the parliament. That's what they all care about.
And because the statistics have become so specific about all of that they only have to target key demographics or key seats or it is rather dismissive of the broader culture. Yeah.
Well, thank you, Thomas, so much.
Thank you
for this. For the recipe of this episode, you can check out Pran's POV Kitchen on the Facebook page, and also there will be a link in the description of this podcast. I will see you soon. Ciao. And that's it for another episode on Trans POV Kitchen on Joy 94.9. You can check us out on our Facebook page, Trans POV Kitchen, with space in between. Here's your host, Anastasia Lee, and I shall see you over the stove next time. Ciao.